Well, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to Holden Village. If you haven't been welcomed already, or I think we need as many welcomes as we can get. It's one of the gifts of Holden, is continually extending the table to people, reminding them that they are welcomed here and accepted here. And so if anyone who hasn't heard a welcome yet, through the Spirit, I say good morning and welcome to you here.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Wangenhoek. I am a pastor and I'm a mission developer of a specific congregation in the Southwestern Washington Synod, part of the ELCA, and my church is the Living Stones Prison Congregation. It is a church of all incarcerated men who come together every Saturday night for worship, who we have a church council that works together to help plan worship and make sure worship happens. We have a praise band that gets together every Saturday to practice and plan music. We have a newsletter. We even have an offering service that men are able to transfer money off their private stores onto the chapel fund, and we give our money to a nonprofit in Mason County. So in every way, we try and be church. But also, it is a member church of the ELCA, the Southwestern Washington Synod, and so every Saturday night, people come to worship from a different church with the men of the Living Stones. Churches from Federal Way, from Vancouver, from Bremerton, all the churches of that specific geographic synod, the Southwestern Washington Synod. We're going to talk today about criminal actions and society reactions. And throughout the week, when we come to talk about prison ministry, I'm going to remind us that this material is charged. It's emotionally charged. There are going to be people who will come to these sessions who have either been a victim of violent crime or who have had a family member who's been a victim of violent crime. And they bring a wealth of experience to this room that I myself cannot provide and do not have. And some things that will be said will stir up emotions. Also, there are people potentially who will come to these classes who have a family member who's in prison or has been in prison. And they, too, have a wealth of experience that I do not have and cannot provide. And when some things are said, they're going to have an emotional reaction and something to share. And, of course, people who may be from both ends are going to be in this room together. And either one has the potential of saying something that's going to raise something else in someone else, raise up something. There could even be people who have formerly committed crimes who have been to prison here today. We just don't know. And so when we want to share something and say something, let's take a moment to ponder who else is the room, who else is in the room, take responsibility for what we say, and all of us trust in the safety of being able to say it and in the ambiguity of being able to say it. Because someone who has a son in prison is going to say, "My son's a good boy." And someone else whose daughter's been a victim of violent crime, even if it wasn't the same person, is going to say, "Was it a good boy who did what he did to my daughter?" These are going to raise things in us. So we can all take a deep breath and trust the Spirit is with us and let it out. Amen. So I want to first run us through an exercise. Oh goodness, I must have picked it up already. This is a drawing of an iceberg, and it's about them. Who are them? Who are they? The incarcerated. Please, let's start listing. Just call it out. List crimes we have in the world. What are crimes we have in whatever state we come from? What are our crimes?
Rape.
Okay. Whoa, that's not the pen I wanted. I'll use this one.
Robbery.
Rape.
Murder.
Robbery.
Abuse.
Murder. Abuse.
Theft.
Theft.
Assault.
Assault.
Arson.
Arson.
Fraud.
Fraud. Okay. We've covered covered quite a few. There's little nuances, rape of children, rape of adults, assault, manslaughter, homicide, one. Different things. So we've covered that.
Harassment.
Drunk driving.
Stalking. Being a better pen than the one I've got.
I'll go upstairs.
I brought some myself.
Yeah.
It's just that the ones I had. Hey, you're stalking?
Drug possession.
Possession? Drug possession?
Bullying.
What was that second one?
Bullying.
Bullying.
Yeah.
Assault, murder, it kind of covered.
Okay.
Harassment.
Dealing.
Drug dealing. Can we think of anything else? Okay. Now, underneath the water, let's think about and name what are the emotions, the emotional motivations. Ask us to step into the feet of someone who would do one of these things. And what were the emotions they might have been feeling at the time, or were leading up to the time? Fear.
Anger.
Okay, anger.
Greed.
Greed.
Lust. Desperation.
Despair.
Powerlessness.
Can we put a slash there and then say control? It's not quite an emotion, but just needing that thing. What else?
Arrogance.
I'm not sure if this fits, but addiction. And I don't know if that would fit into the category or not. But
addiction might cover some of the, like, these things help
addiction
create that.
Generating anger, powerlessness, so on.
Addiction to anger, the need.
Confusion.
Confusion? We'll put addiction just to take it up as an offering. Confusion?
Hopelessness.
Hatred.
Rage.
Mental illness.
Lots of people are mentally ill. They don't necessarily commit a crime.
Yeah, true.
What would people be feeling at the time they did this?
Right.
Vengeful.
Right. How about love?
Could
love be a possibility?
Yeah.
An example I might throw out is a man and his wife divorce. They have a little daughter. The man learns through the grapevine that the wife has a new boyfriend. And after 3 months of dating, finds out that the new boyfriend has been very nice and very gracious to babysit the daughter while the ex-wife goes out with her girlfriends to the bars. And they're going to, you know, camp out in the pup tent and all these things, and it just doesn't look good. And whether or not anything is happening that is truly not good, he gets scared, wants to be protective, and does something about it. Things like that can happen, and do happen. Any other things?
Jealousy.
Isolation.
Sure. Feeling alone, loneliness. Insecurity, maybe, because with that. What else?
I think there's a part of isolation which is feeling that you simply have not been heard.
Not
no
heard.
One cares about you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's one word for that.
Out of control, insecure.
Shame.
I still want to, Phil is on to some, maybe just depression, sorrow.
Unloved.
Yeah.
Abandonment.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
There can be a feeling of victimization.
Yes. Off oftentimes that is the victimization is what motivates the wife murdering the husband. She's tired of the abuse. Doesn't make it right, but she's at wit's end. Anything else?
Anxious.
Maybe anxiety.
You have hate down there.
Hatred. Yep.
Yeah,
it's starting to get to the point where there's so much I can't even see it.
Yeah.
All right. That is the incarcerated. This is us. What do we do? What are our actions that we take when a man or woman does this stuff up here? What do?
Judge.
We judge? Okay. What's the first thing we do?
We get angry.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
First thing we do, I see a man assaulting another man or a woman. What do?
Try to stop it.
Potentially arrest?
Call the police.
Stop? Call the police.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's not everyone.
It isn't everyone.
A lot of people just don't want to get involved because it's too complicated.
Possibly look the other way.
Yeah.
But he is arrested, but ultimately, let's say he is arrested. Then what happens?
After the
arrest.
You have to follow up.
Part prosecution?
Yeah.
Lock up? Yeah, incarceration.
Well, before we prosecute, we can prosecute people, we haven't determined their guilt yet.
It has to be found guilty.
Yeah.
Convicted.
Yeah, we stall too. Oh, man.
Yep, convicted, long or short. After conviction?
Sentencing.
This is a lot of times in court. Then, after sentencing, what do?
Incarcerate.
Lock up.
Yep. Or parole.
Mm-hmm. With parole, though, is actually a form of lockup. It's just that you get to be with your family, or at least be on the outside, but you're still under the jurisdiction of the state. Lots of people on both sides forget that.
You take away their voting rights.
Mm-hmm. Voting rights. Yep.
For felons.
What else do we do?
We isolate them. We try to keep
them
out of our lives. We
mm-hmm.
shun them.
Mm-hmm. Isolate, shun.
You give them a lifetime record.
Lifetime record. Yeah, give
yeah.
a record.
And we never want to let them out. We never give them a job. We never talk nice about them. We convict them forever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we try to forget about it.
Yeah, we do forget. You ever watch a news story? You watch a real prominent crime on the news. You see the actual crime all the way through the sentencing and off to jail. We don't hear a word about it until
right.
maybe 20 years later when he's coming out.
And then there's an uproar.
Yeah.
But
if they are coming out, do we do anything for them while they're inside?
Sometimes.
No, we don't do anything after they get out either.
Mm. Well, at least
well,
in the state.
I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know what happened.
There are certain rehabilitation. There's
yeah.
there's some rehabilitating anger management classes.
Yeah, it depends on the
victim
crime.
Awareness.
Alcohol drug treatment.
Yeah, we sometimes involve yeah treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, we rehabilitate. We treat.
We hope.
We attempt to fix.
Yeah.
Restitution.
Does everyone know what that is?
No.
Mm-hmm. Restitution is usually the financial piece. Paying back what was stolen, paying back the damages done. Require restitution. What else might we do?
We might love them.
We might love them. Care about them.
I don't know if we love them. We might forgive them, but that doesn't really mean loving them.
No, I think we can love them. Sometimes we love them.
If we can.
I have a friend that's in jail, and I love the fact that he's in jail because I love him. I don't want him to get out.
And you know where he's at.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. And
yep.
I know what he's not doing.
What to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So, what's underneath our iceberg? What are our emotions when we do this?
Sadness.
Sadness?
Fear.
Fear, uh-huh.
Shame.
Shame.
Loss.
Loss.
Ambivalence.
Ambivalence.
Amen. Anger.
Vengeance.
Vengeance. You might have to repeat some of these because I can only write so fast. I got anger.
Superiority.
Superiority.
And do we feel superior?
Pride. Mm-hmm.
Righteous indignation?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's never going to happen.
Kicking it up a
notch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't Job supposed to be, have some righteous indignation? His wife seemed to.
Right.
You were at Bible study earlier.
Right.
What other emotions? That we have when we do these things?
Arrogance.
Arrogance?
Yeah.
Satisfaction.
Satisfaction!
Yeah.
Can you, that's a good word, it's a big word. Can you say some emotions that acquired with satisfaction?
We did our job.
We did our job. We did our job. Oh, that's
restored order.
Restored order,
control.
We did our job. What are the
control?
Control.
Control.
I'm really sitting with, we did our job. What's the emotion? That's some good words, some good language there.
Chief.
Do it as pride.
Pride.
Satisfaction, accomplishment.
Accomplishment, wow. That's a good
justice,
one.
Maybe.
Justice?
How about safety? I don't know if you had that in there.
Safety, yeah.
Safety, a sense of safety, a
sure.
sense of control.
Security,
yeah.
Yeah,
security, safety.
You won't be doing that again.
Yeah. We feel a sense of shame there.
There is shame?
Yeah. If it's our relative.
Okay.
What is the feeling of disgust? Is it one of those?
Disgust. Maybe that's just a good one in and of
itself.
Isn't that awful?
Yeah, that's
a real good
one.
Mm-hmm. It's awful.
Yeah.
I think that hopelessness.
Hopelessness! I've heard these words before.
This is just, the only way that we know how to deal with it.
Yeah, this is it. You know, it's like, what else are you going to do?
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah. Any others?
Did you have helplessness? Is that the same as hopelessness?
Helplessness?
Yeah.
Sure, helplessness.
We feel helpless in Pierce County where we put people
goodness gracious
away for, and then when they get out, they don't get out. They're still in another prison they built right beside the first prison. On McNeil Island,
mm-hmm.
sex offenders
mm-hmm.
are still in jail.
Special treatment,
treatment
unit, when they're done with their sentence. What she's saying for anyone not from Tacoma or state of Washington, if we have a sex offender specifically who is showing psychiatric issues and we feel it's related to his propensity to recommitting his crimes, we could have him civilly committed in the special sex offender unit on McNeil Island, where he is to stay until he is considered well.
So it's really a life sentence.
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be. I don't know anyone who's been released yet from the special sex offender unit.
Okay.
So there are.
Minnesota has the same.
Okay. Sure. Sure.
They consider it incurable.
Yeah. Well, there's a real sensational story which I'm not going to repeat that led to that unit being created, where a man had done one outrageous act. And 6 months after he got out of prison, did another different but emotionally equally outrageous act. That it's like, boom, you gotta do something. Desperation. Do we have desperation up here?
No.
We don't. But I've heard the word desperation before. In fact, I think I've heard all these words down here before. Where did I hear them?
Over there.
Yeah.
Right.
Over here. Again, underneath the iceberg. Underneath the ice, this is what we see on the surface.
Right.
This is what we see on the surface, and they're both different. Okay, murder is a lot different than homicide, but underneath here, something different altogether, because it's all the same. You can make a case for any word that we may have forgotten over here. I know we put love over there, we didn't put love here. But is love sometimes, you know, we want our children to be safe. You know? Or, in some cases, we may want the loved one who keeps committing the crime, you know, at least in prison, he's not doing what he's doing. At least he's, you know, there. And anything that's over here, probably belongs over here. Satisfaction. You know, I am so glad I gave that guy exactly what he deserved. Justice. All violence, no matter how crazy and insane, it is argued that all violence is a response for justice. It may not be right justice. It may not be justice that we would all agree with. But to the one who commits it, there is something being satisfied in his or her choices to commit the violence. At the foot of the cross, we're all the same. We all have the same motivations for what we do. And we all have our potential to react and possibility to react. And we're all one decision away from being on either iceberg. Many of the men who are part of the Living Stones admitted that when they were still able to vote, when they hadn't been convicted of a crime, voted for three strikes and you're out. One of my men in the praise band said before he came to prison, he didn't want guys in prison to even have TVs.
My goodness.
Then he came to prison, and boom. So they're very much, you know, they could, if the roles were, if they were not in, they would easily be filling this one up. I love literature. And I love good literature that's real to life. Just as the guys here can, prior to coming to prison, prior to getting caught, will have really wanted and been spoken for any kind of get tough on crime law, we also aren't so far away from being on the other iceberg, one choice away. How many are familiar with Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment? This is a story about a scholarly young student who's very learned. His name is Raskolnikov. Very well mannered, knows lots of stuff, has really thinks through life, very philosophical. And he lives in Russia, and he knows of this loan shark, this old woman who has so many poor people over a barrel. Because they didn't have any money, but they needed money, and they had something of value they could sell to her, they could make a loan to her, and she basically owns them. And including him, because he's had to take things to her to sell, to keep going. And in some ways she's created a lot of misery, and she's not the most pleasant person to be around either. And he starts thinking, what really is crime? Who really is a criminal? He has a friend that he goes and speaks to. This friend is an officer in the army. They like to play games together, cards together. And they start talking about this woman, and Raskolnikov speaks in a hypothetical situation, if I may. Well, listen then. On the other side, fresh young lives, that is, the lives of the people who are under this loan shark, thrown away for want of help and by thousands on every side. 100,000 good deeds could be done and helped on that old woman's money, which will be buried in a monastery. Hundreds, thousands perhaps, might be set on the right path. Dozens of families saved from destitution, from ruin and vice, from hospitals, with and all with her money. Kill her. Take her money, and with the help of it, devote oneself to the service of humanity and the good of all. What do you think? Would not one tiny crime be wiped out by thousands of good deeds? For one life, thousands would be saved from corruption and decay. One death and 100 lives in exchange. It's simple arithmetic. Besides, what value has the life of that sickly, stupid, ill-natured old woman in the balance of existence? No more than the life of a louse, of a black beetle. Less, in fact, because the old woman is doing harm. She's wearing out the lives of others. The other day, she bit Lizaveta's finger out of spite. It almost had to be amputated. They talk some more, and the soldier asks him a question. You are talking in speechifying a way, but tell me, Would you kill the old woman yourself? Oh, of course not, says Raskolnikov. I was only arguing the justice of it. Justice. The need of justice and control underneath both icebergs. Arguing the justice of it. It has nothing to do with me. But I think, said the officer, if you would not do it yourself, there's no justice about it. Let us have another game. Men with too much time on their hands. But he thinks more about this. This has been something that's been cooking up in his head for quite a while. I'm only on page 74 of a large book, but there's all the negative, there's all the pages before the first page where he's been thinking about this. And he starts thinking more. At first, long before indeed, he had been much occupied with one question. Why almost all crimes are so badly concealed and so easily detected? And why almost all criminals leave such obvious traces? He had come gradually to many different and curious conclusions, and in his opinion, the chief reason lay not so much in the material impossibility of concealing the crime as in the criminal himself. So he's toying with the idea, you know, maybe this could work. If you get away with it, it's all right. If it really does good in the end, it's all right. And there's no, you know, there's really the question of saint and sinner here. Is this something that could be good? Is this something that could be bad? Dostoevsky has some different opinions than Brother Marty. Almost every criminal is subject to failure of will, reasoning power by a childish and phenomenal heedlessness. They're all a bunch of compulsive ADHD, you know. They just need, you know, they need so many medications. At the very instant when prudence and caution are most essential, and they certainly don't have that. It was his conviction, Raskolnikov's conviction, that this eclipse of reason and failure of willpower attacked a man like a disease, developed gradually and reached its highest point just before the perpetration of the crime, continued with equal violence at the moment of the crime and for longer or shorter time after, according to the individual case. When he reached these conclusions, he decided that in his own case, there could be no such morbid reaction, that his reason and will would remain unimpaired at the time of carrying out his design, for the single reason that his design was not a crime.
Whoa.
The rationalization.
Right.
The self-justification. And we justify just about anything. You know, give a guy 3 life sentences. Do something horrible to a child. We all do it. What Raskolnikov's true problem is, and what he's going to spend the rest of the book doing, is examining himself. And finally realizing, no matter who he's been in the past, he is no different. He finds that when he commits his crime, he makes every crazy mistake that any low-down, no-willpower, unplanning criminal would make. He is a criminal. One guy shared a story about after his crime, he ran from the police. He had to, you know, jump over or crawl through some fences that had barbed wire, so he cut himself. His shirt was bloody. Sides were bloody, scratched up. He was extremely muddy. He got arrested and was taken first to the holding area. And there he is, sitting in jail, bloody, muddy, crummy. And he's looking around at all the other guys and he said, wow, these are the dregs of society. And he admitted at that time, he didn't even realize his own condition. His own condition. We're only one choice away. We're only one justification away. Oftentimes with sex crimes, there was both men have stated it, it started out small. You know, it's just pornography on the internet.
Yeah.
It's just hanging out at the park watching. It's just talking to my nephew about these issues. Each little step took it further. We make little choices every day. And so that brings us to the first crime story the Bible has to offer us. At least the first crime story that I'm going to speak about. If you have your Bible, I invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 4. This is normally the story we call Cain and Abel. We might discover, really, since Abel never actually speaks, it's really the story of Cain and God. I'd like to read first the first 7 verses. Now, the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel for his part brought of the firstlings of his flock, the fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. In ancient culture, according to human tradition and human laws, the firstborn son would be the child of favor, would be the one who would inherit the land, would be the one who would get the most attention from mom and dad. And throughout the scriptures, we see God pay no attention to human tradition. God consistently favors the second born, the second child. We lift the first one up. Well, God loves him, but God raises the second one, perhaps even higher. And of course, Cain, whose name means to get, to create, future possibilities, and Abel's name means nothingness, vapor, without possibility of life. One, however, is favored, and it's not Cain. How would you feel?
Angry.
Angry. Exactly. Depressed. All these emotions underneath the water, the bottom part of the iceberg. And God comes to Cain. And he mentions the obvious. You're angry. Your countenance is low. And then in essence says, so what are you going to do about it? And it's not that God does not love Cain. God has come to speak to Cain. It doesn't show us God going and speaking to Abel. Hey, wasn't that great what I did for you? But he comes to Cain. There is a relationship between God and Cain. At least for God's part. God's reaching out. But God's also reaching out with some warning. Hey, you've got to look into this. You've got this anger. You don't master it. Right by the door is sin. What's above the iceberg? Ready to take you any place it wants to go. So we know how the story goes. But what could happen at this point? Anybody? verse 7, God has sat down with Cain and said to him, sin's waiting at the door.
I'm sorry.
He could say. He could go to his brother Abel and reconcile. What else could he do? Could he be happy for Abel?
Maybe later.
Maybe later. Could he look at...
It would take me a while.
Could he look differently at Abel?
Yeah.
Could there be a relationship between Cain and Abel?
Yeah.
You know, God would prefer, you know, not God has not sought to separate Abel from Cain. He said, we're going to throw Cain away. Mm-hmm. But can Cain and Abel be together? You know, go to your brother. And almost this, that perhaps the story of the prodigal son is in some ways being played out. Where the father goes to the older and son and says, will you come into this party and be happy for your brother who's returned to us? God saying to Cain, you know, get the better of this. Get the better of your anger. Go to your brother. Be reconciled. Thing is, crime is a choice. Just as how we deal with crime is a choice. We're always making choices. It was Raskolnikov's problem. He thought somehow philosophically, you know, this was just a good way to be. This was something that needed to be done. This was fate. It could be accomplished. No, he was making a choice the whole way. Same way that we make choices. If we take away a person's ability to choose, if we say they have no choice, we are saying they're not fully human. We're saying they're not fully who God created them to be. Now, of course, we are in bondage to sin. And while I hate doing this to people, we'll talk more about that tomorrow when you may not be here. Today, we're talking more about our own responsibility, our own choices. Whether it's how we commit crime, how we deal with crime. The murder is not inevitable. God's warning and encouraging of Cain to work through his anger. God warns Cain, if he doesn't work through it, sin will take him. But verse 8 comes along. Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out to the field. And again, we never hear from Abel. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? There's some ambivalence even in the iceberg over here. Now guys might not even have that empathy for what they've done. And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground. Now I'd like to take a step back and say, Cain is not cursed from God. Cain is cursed from the ground that has received the blood of Abel. There are consequences for the choices we make. A man who kills his wife will have nightmares the rest of his life. He will see the light go out of her eyes many times in his dreams, in his memories.
Do they talk about that?
One man came to me talking about forgiveness. Understands about forgiveness from God. Understands about forgiveness from a victim, though he will not have the opportunity to ask for that. But he says, how can I forgive myself? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if I forgive myself, am I saying it's okay? Like it's no big deal. And I said, well, you're confusing. Try this on for size. You're confusing justification with forgiveness. We can justify anything. As one of my men said, I'm a manipulator. I can take anything and find a reason for it. This guy was struggling, you know, with the difference. You know, we don't need forgiveness if we haven't done anything wrong. And that can be a very humbling thing. That really takes us into truth-telling on our own part. Consider every time in worship, in our liturgy, where we have a confession of forgiveness of sin. We're not asking for forgiveness just in case. We're asking for forgiveness because there are sins that we have done. Ones we know about and are willing to talk about. Ones we know about and are not willing to talk about. Ones we haven't even considered. But we're not being forgiven because we're okay. We're being forgiven because we are sinners. Whether or not we have to answer to the state for our sin, as many of the men of the Living Stones have to answer to the state for their sin, we still have to answer to God. We're still at the same ground, at the same cross, with men in prison. So the curse comes from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. You know, God is seeing what's going to happen to Cain and giving him the bad news. God's not delivering it. God is confessing. You know, it's when counselors or in my case as a chaplain, so you have to sit down with a guy and say, look, your crime is going to follow you even when you leave prison. You are always going to have to practice humility. You are always going to have to live with the limits put on your life because of what happened. Helping people to step in and face those difficult, those sad, and in some cases, necessary truths. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil." Cain's blaming God. God has just told him the curse came from the ground.
Yeah.
Cain is still struggling with the consequences of his own actions. Diane Jacobson shared with me before her session, she was once on a jury trial of a murderer who, to his last moment, insisted he hadn't done it and was going to spend the rest of his life appealing the case. And she identified such a powerful thing. How can you receive forgiveness if you can't even admit guilt? Mm-hmm. Cain is struggling with that. You know, there's really not, Cain's really not giving God anything. It's kind of like the rich man in the story of Lazarus and the rich man in the parable, where the rich man is now in the fires of hell. He's so thirsty, and he says to Moses, send Lazarus to bring me water. I could take it from his finger. And Moses says, look, my brother. Look, my child. Moses is actually, again, relating to the rich man. There's actually a relationship between Father Moses and the rich man, even though the rich man is burning in hell. They are relating to each other. They are talking with each other. You received yours while you were alive. Lazarus is receiving his now. And in a sense, Moses is speaking to Lazarus as God is speaking to Cain. But Moses is speaking to the rich man as God is speaking to Cain. But again, the rich man in that parable says, well, send somebody to warn my brothers. He's still not owning up to what he did or didn't do when he was alive. And yet, Moses does not abandon the rich man. And neither does God abandon Cain. Then the Lord said to him, not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Consequences of Cain's actions forced Cain away. When a man commits a crime, we have no immediate assurance that this isn't going to reoccur. What do we do? We certainly struggle. And our first bet, our first line of defense is send away. But that's still our brother in Christ. That was still somebody's child. Somebody loved that man when he was little. Somebody saw to it that he could grow up. That's still a precious child of God. And God still sends a blessing with him for his safety, for his life. God and Cain have to figure out how to live together. God gives him a mark. We live in jeopardy of choosing not to love, yet God has mercy. We end with the guilty one going away, but also being met by surprising grace. While we can never erase our past, while we can never regain our innocence, we yet have grace in God. Cain did what could not be taken back, and God also suffers in the relationship. He can't stop Cain from being a fugitive and a wanderer of the earth. Those are the consequences. God can't keep a guy back from prison. But God can send us in. So what can we learn from ourselves in our relationship with people who are in prison? What are the values that we can gain from this?
Say it again.
What can we learn about how to relate to someone in prison through God's demonstration towards Cain?
God continues to love and support his child. Mm-hmm.
And is that love any different from the love we receive?
What motivated you to do jail ministry?
I think in my own life it was a haphazard, surprising events of life. While I was in seminary, I needed to complete a clinical pastoral education. And my wife, for those who don't know what that is, that's 500 hours of intensive counseling time in a crisis center, such as a hospital. My wife had already been accepted into a program in the Bay Area, and I wanted to stay in the same area as my wife. And as I was not getting accepted into other programs, an opportunity came up to do a CPE in a jail.
Gotcha.
And that's where I was surprised and amazed and brought into a world where everything I was learning in seminary was becoming incarnate in the men that I was called at that time to minister to. And also in turn had to teach me to face a lot in myself. I think one thing we can learn is the power and the opportunity of every choice we make. You know, every moment is a Kairos moment, is a God moment, when we take the time to look.
I think in addition to the point, the theological thesis analogizing to Cain and Abel, which I agree with, I think there's also, for lack of a better phrase, a humanistic argument that is entirely consistent with that as well, but for admittedly a different rationale. And that's the notion that society has a tendency to jettison those who are incarcerated, obviously during their incarceration, but perhaps more importantly, subsequent to their incarceration. And I think the question is, does society have some obligation above and beyond those who participate in the criminal justice system to assist in facilitating their rehabilitation, if you accept the proposition that in fact rehabilitation is possible? And I think rehabilitation is possible when you consider the fact that in many communities, including Pierce County, roughly 90% of the people before the system are those who are addicted to, typically it's methamphetamine, but not exclusively.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the, if you will, the allied and perhaps even the greater question that you seize upon with your thesis.
I would say there's responsibility on all sides. I remember when they're in the after the Rodney King beatings, there was and the riot and the insurgence that took place in L.A. There was a sermon that was part of a sermon that had been delivered in a public area by an African American preacher, talked about who all was at fault, and it included, you know, Rodney King for speeding. That was the first part. Then, of course, it included the officers who went beyond and beyond belief in procedures and policies. Then it went to and on and on, and everybody was convicted. If anyone has ever seen the movie Do the Right Thing by, I forget the...
Spike Lee.
I'm naming the wrong movie. Not Do the Right Thing. The movie was... It's a principal, African-American principal. Comes to an inner city school, and the first thing he does is his responsibility as the principal is to make a safe environment, so every student who has a criminal record is kicked out of the school immediately in front of all the kids who have never committed a crime. Thrown out, you're gone. Then he says to all the kids, I expect every student here to have their homework done. I expect every student here to behave, or the same will happen to you. I expect every student here to be able to sing the school song.
Okay.
He starts, I mean, basically, it's everybody. Everybody, and then he goes up to the superintendent. How come that high school in that neighborhood gets all this money, and my high school, which needs the money, gets nothing? Whoever he talks to, including himself, he demands what we are responsible for. And that includes the person who makes these choices, and that includes us, who make the choices we do. We have a record of men who have committed nonviolent crimes, who have returned to prison on a violent crime.
Really?
Prison, as we'll learn more this week, forces a guy to live differently. One man, as he explained it, when he left prison, he treated somebody in a bar the way he would treat someone in a prison to get what he wanted. And it didn't work. It led to a fight. He couldn't intimidate another person like he would in prison, like he learned in prison. It led to another fight. And he's back in prison. We have all week to talk. I'm available for questions. And I'll see you tomorrow at 4. If you want to come back.
Thank you.